Welcome to the Future Thinkers Podcast, episode number 39. This is the second half of our interview with psychology professor Jordan Peterson. In this episode, we talk about Jung's archetypes, psychedelics, and Jordan's definition of enlightenment. It's quite an interesting episode. The topic range is a bit different than the previous half. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Before we get into it, there's a few things I want to address from the last episode. We got a bunch of hate on our YouTube and our podcast channel. So I actually just want to talk about it a little bit because it brings up an interesting point that is really relevant to Jordan Peterson's central point, which is people who want to run away from criticism or run away from opposing ideas. So I'm just going to read out one of our main comments that I thought was pretty ridiculous. I've listened to your podcast for years and I've very much enjoyed it until now. This man is an idiot with a decent vocabulary. I will never visit your website again. Trans people are not a subcategory of gay people. Are you kidding me right now? I'm so furious. Furious because I really thought you folks were future thinkers. Gendered pronouns serve no purpose. Okay, so main point here is what Jordan Peterson talks about, one of his favorite authors, which is Dostoevsky. What Dostoevsky does when he builds up a character is he tries to make the protagonist the antagonist and the antagonist the protagonist, meaning he tries to build up all of the virtues of the guy you're supposed to hate so that you like him and you sympathize with him. The benefits of doing this is that you see the pros and cons of both sides of a very difficult argument. And, you know, in the situation with what Jordan Peterson is talking about, especially when it comes to censoring language, he says that's absolutely not something we should be doing. We should be open to all opinions and then make judgment calls based off of information, full conversations that we have. And what people have been suggesting on our podcast and in emails and comments and that sort of stuff is that we do not have people on the podcast who are of different opinions than we or our audience. And that's something that I'm 100% opposed to. We have to have people on that we disagree with. We have to build up opposing sides and understand the perspectives of people who are against us. That said, I'm actually really not against Jordan Peterson because I've dived in so deeply to his content. He has a lot of really good ideas and he describes them quite well. And if the people who had commented on our post or sent us emails had done this kind of research that we had, they might actually be more on their side. The thing is, you might learn something when you don't surround yourself with people who are already in your echo chamber. So that's something I just really felt like I needed to get off my chest and talk about at the beginning of this episode, because it's just strange that people would want to hear only opinions that support their own opinions. That's the slowest way to learn. Any thoughts about that, Yvie?
Yeah, I think there's other things to be said about Jordan Peterson, that he talks about the weak parts of social justice warrior movement. This is a little bit of a sidestep, but it just explains my thinking. Recently, I've been learning a lot about Ken Wilber's integral model, and it talks about different stages of development in your thinking. And fifth stage of development is the postmodern thinking, which is where a lot of social justice warriors rest. However, in every stage of development, you can have pathology and problems. And if people become overdeveloped in a certain area and underdeveloped in other areas, they can become kind of totalitarian about their mode of thinking. And that's what happens with social justice warriors. So on one hand, where they're coming from is they want justice and equality and they want everybody to be heard. But on the other hand, they become like overprotective mothers about it, where they're just going to slay everybody who is offending them with words. Oh my God. I do understand that wanting justice and equality and everybody to be heard is a noble pursuit, but it just goes too far with this movement. And that's what Jordan Peterson is trying to point out. He's not saying that justice and equality are bad. He's just trying to point out, this is your problem, sort your stuff out, and then go on with your goal of justice and equality. That's fine.
Then let's continue having productive conversation from that point. But this whole idea of like shutting down the conversation because you're too fragile to even hear opposing opinions is ridiculous.
Yeah. I grew up in Soviet Union, so I'm very familiar with people's free speech being censored. People who grew up in North America don't understand how bad it can get when you try to control what people can say and can't say. It can get really bad. In Soviet Union, you could be in your kitchen having a conversation with your friend, and then your neighbor hears you through the wall while you are in your private apartment. and then goes and reports on you to the government that you said something against the political leader. And then you can disappear forever. And this happened to thousands of people in Soviet Union. This is not a joke. So this is where things can go if you start censoring people's language.
By disappear, you're not saying like a vacation at a nice resort where you don't come back from. You're talking about being murdered and then dumped in a ditch somewhere.
In a ditch. Or being sent off to Siberia before the internet, before they could track people, and you're working as a slave in the gulag. These things were real. Look them up. You have to be really careful with censoring language. Just don't do it.
This whole Western liberal bubble thing keeps popping up, and I think it's interesting that people are so surprised that we would be sided with Jordan Peterson, because his actual background of study and some of his favorite authors are from the Russian sort of like pre-collapse era.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuff is something that you and I have had so many conversations about, but also from travel we've experienced other ways of thinking and cultures that are completely opposite to the way things are done in the West. And this whole perpetuation of babying people and censoring ideas and you've got to be protected from words is something that can actually lead to a very censored totalitarian government state. That's why he's so vocal about speaking out about this stuff. So if you find yourself disagreeing with someone like Jordan Peterson, maybe dive into the opposing argument a little more and really understand why you disagree and why his opinions are so upsetting to you. The worst thing that can happen is either you get converted because you have more information or you have a better basis through which to argue with your opponent through. So that's the whole idea with Dostoevsky. Is build up your opponent, research your opponent's perspective so well that you could actually make the argument on their behalf,
mm-hmm.
and then destroy their argument from that total being that you've created for your opposition. Either way, you win.
Last thing before we get into this episode, I want to say thank you to our recent patrons and donors, Matthew, the Ladybug Japan Music, Katie, and Chris. Thanks for helping us make this show possible.
Oh yeah, and we got some exciting news. So the first round of the Eternity crowd sale went live. If you've been listening to our last couple of episodes, you're probably already familiar with Eternity. Their technology is about enabling mainstream level scalability, privacy, and lightning fast transaction speed of the blockchain. So they just finished their first round of their contribution campaign. They raised 120,000 Ether, which is equivalent to about $6 million at the current exchange rate. Fortunately, if you did miss the last round of funding and you still want to participate, the second round is going to start on May 21st, 2017. So you've still got a chance to check it out, contribute. I highly recommend you learn as much as you can about it. And you should never contribute or donate or whatever, any amount of money that you are afraid to lose. So this has got to be your investing pocket change kind of stuff. So for more details, go to futurethinkers.org/eternity, AETERNITY, or go to futurethinkers.org/AE for short.
And to get any show notes, books, mentions, and other things we talk about in this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/39. Okay, let's get into it.
Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova.
To get notified of new podcasts and videos, go to futurethinkers.org and subscribe to our mailing list. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, give us a like or a review, share it with your friends, and consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/futurethinkers. If you're looking to get serious about meditation, check out the meditation app that we've created with Vinay Gupta called The Cutting Machinery. Go to cuttingmachinery.org/app.
Last but not least, if you want to get access to more content, hidden episodes, or if you just want to chat with us and previous guests, then check out our community at community.futurethinkers.org.
I wanted to bring you back to Jung and the idea of archetypes and sort of digging up and discovering all the absolutely darkest, most horrible parts of yourself and recognizing that they're there.
Yeah.
And feeling those feelings fully and realizing that you're capable of doing some horrible things before you can reconcile that you're also capable of good.
Well, that's the thing. This is also why the safe space idea is so bad. So one of the things I do in my Maps of Meaning course, and to some degree in my personality courses, I try to get the students to understand how it was that they could have been Nazis. To actually understand that. To think, okay, I'm an Auschwitz guard. What am I like? Because I could do that. Well, it's horrifying to understand that. But if you understand that you could have been an Auschwitz guard, which it's a hard thing to understand, but then you're going to be a lot more careful when you discipline your children. I'll tell you that, because you'll think, oh yeah, I'm a monster. I better be careful. I could do something. Not only could I do something bad, I probably will. You know, and you see parents treat their children terribly often, terribly. Although it's usually much slower than a sudden torturous death. It's some horrible battle drawn out over decades. The underlying impetus is the same. Everyone loves their children. Yeah, sure. No. And that's another Freudian observation. It's like Freud was very smart. Parents love their children, but they hate them too. And the feeling is amply repaid by the children. You have to take that whole dynamic into account. You have to understand that you could easily hate your child, easily. And so you be careful and awake, and maybe you can avoid that, but you have to be awake. And you can't be awake unless you know you're a monster. You're asleep until you know that. You know, one of the things that I learned from Jung was that I learned why people aren't enlightened. Because hypothetically, you could be. I mean, that's the theory, right? There have been enlightened people, and certainly we assume that being enlightened is a good thing. Well, if you can be enlightened, then why isn't everyone enlightened? Well, you might say that the degree that you become enlightened is proportionate to the depth of the darkest place you've ever visited. And so that's a pretty good barrier.
What's your definition of enlightenment?
Well, I would say there's two elements to it. One is that you're truly working to make things better. And you can start with your own presumption about what better would be. But I mean better. And part of that would be that you're trying to decrease unnecessary suffering. That's not all there is to it. But if you need an anchor point, that's a good one. You should try to decrease unnecessary suffering. You should tell the truth. Those are the two fundamental elements, I think, is that you're oriented towards the good, and that you continue to improve that orientation because you understand that your definition of good is insufficient, so it has to transform. But at the same time, you try to speak the truth. And so the truth issue is an interesting one. And this is, I think, the proper way to understand faith, because faith doesn't mean believing a bunch of things you know not to be true. That's stupidity. That's not faith. So here's a way of thinking about it. So imagine that when you're talking to someone, you want something from them. You want their recognition. You want to dominate the conversation. You want to stand out. But there's an aim. There's a goal. You're treating the person and the conversation like a means to an end. And maybe you do that with your speech all the time. You're always using it as a tool to obtain some end. You see this, probably the extreme of this is the pickup artist community, right? Mm-hmm. So their whole scheme is how to craft their words in a manipulative manner. It's all acting, right? How to present yourself as a dominant male so that you can attract sexual partners. It isn't how to be a good man so you can attract women. It's how to present yourself falsely. I'm satirizing it to some degree, because the community is useful insofar as it gets men to stop being afraid of women. But forget about that for a minute. So that's the use of speech instrumentally. That's one way of thinking about it. But here's another way of using speech. You try to say what you think as clearly as you can, period. And then you let whatever happen, happen. And the faith there, here's the faith idea there, is that whatever happens if you tell the truth is the best thing that could have possibly happened. It's a presumption, and you have to make presumptions to move forward in life. And so you think, well, if being is good, then a truthful relationship with it is the proper relationship. And you might say, well, how do you know that the outcome is going to be good? It's like, you never know if the outcome is going to be good. That's the problem. You never know. So you have to assume. And so there is a deep idea. I think it's a core religious idea. It's certainly extraordinarily well developed in Christianity, that your fundamental moral obligation is to tell the truth, period. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, people say, well, you know, what about truths that hurt people's feelings? It's like, you're not supposed to be stupid when you tell the truth. You're supposed to be wise. And so, for example, this is a funny little anecdote, I suppose, to illustrate the point. So you're out clothing shopping with your girlfriend or your wife, and she says, does this dress make me look fat? Well, what's the answer? You say, well, no. Well, maybe that's a white lie. And maybe it isn't, but maybe it is. That isn't what you say. You say, I don't answer questions like that. That's the truth in that situation, right? Because a white lie is obviously there are levels of seriousness to being deceitful. And sometimes you tell a white lie because you can't come up with a truth that isn't more harmful. But it's still not right. It's not optimal. There's a truth there that you could tell if you could get it right. And you don't just like bang out your stupid observations casually just because they happen to be accurate in that microcosmic moment, you know. You have to be sophisticated when you tell the truth, which is partly why you need to be oriented towards the good in a fundamental way. And you have to shake off your resentment of being in order to be oriented towards the good. And that's very hard because being makes people suffer. And so everyone's angry about that. And if you're angry, you can't be oriented towards the good because you're out for destruction.
How do you shake off your resentment of being?
Gratitude helps. Start noticing the invisible things you have around you that shield you from catastrophe. But you also have to kind of understand what catastrophe is, you know, and history can really help you with that. You know, if you do some reading about people who've really had problems, you know, they're starving, they're freezing, they're tyrannized, they're terrified, which is kind of the common lot of mankind, you know. If you understand that, and you also understand how you could be complicit in such things, you start to become grateful when you're not in the middle of a revolution with no power and freezing to death, because that's a more likely condition, right? Entropy is the more likely condition. And one of the things that we're not taught in our school systems is that we should be grateful. It's like, Jesus, our culture, our civilization is an absolute bloody miracle. I can never believe it works. It requires so many impossible things to be functioning properly at the same time that, you know, I went through the Tesla factory about a month and a half ago. That place is just unbelievable. It's a mile square, approximately, maybe 3/4 of a mile. So it's a huge building. And inside there, it's just densely packed with high-tech robotic material. And it's defunct now. They're going to build a better one that's like a quarter the size and five times the efficiency. There's all this complex machinery there, and it's all powered, and all of it works. It's just unbelievable, you know. It's so improbable that all of that would work. And that's just a tiny little fraction of what's keeping our society working. Jesus, it's amazing. And what's even more amazing is that it's really damaged people who are doing this, because people are damaged. And so, you know, they go out to work, even though their father has Alzheimer's and, you know, they have an alcohol problem and their stupid kid is experimenting with meth, and maybe their job is in trouble and they have financial difficulty, and out they go and fix the power lines and, you know, fix your plumbing and everything works. It's amazing. And if you know how horrible you are, and if you know how unlikely that is, then that will make you more grateful than resentful.
It makes life look a lot easier than maybe it appears to be.
You mean the fact that we're protected by all this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, yes. Well, that's partly why archaic people initiate their young men. It's like, okay, we're going to take you out somewhere and we're going to make you face the devils and demons of your imagination. We'll put you in a cave for a week. Every horrible thing you can imagine is going to come and visit you in that cave. Some real things and some imaginary things, but all horrible. And when you get out, you'll know the difference between a real problem and a pseudo problem.
And we don't have that in our culture at all.
No, and it's a problem, you see, because everything that works, you immediately take for granted. It's how your brain is organized, because if it works, you don't have to pay attention to it. And so it's like, this is what I think about these bloody radical professors. It's like, here's a leftist professor at a university. They're in a fort. That's their office. That's in a fort. That's the building. That's in a fort. That's the university. That's in a fort. That's the town. That's inside another fort, the state, and another fort, the country. And they stand on top of that saying, the system is corrupt. It's like, oh, that's really great, man. You're in like 10 forts and you're protected enough to complain about the corruption of the system. And while you're in that fort, people give you food. The system is corrupt. And then they think, I'm brave for standing up against it. It's like, you're not brave. You're so bloody protected that there's never been a human being on the planet in the entire history of mankind that is as protected as you.
So I'm interested if you've talked about psychedelics and their role in culture and initiation.
Now, why are you curious about that?
Because I've read a lot of Terence McKenna, and I have been interested in initiation as a thing that's missing from all culture. And I think historically, psychedelics have played a big role in that initiation process.
I met Dennis McKenna last year.
How was that conversation?
Oh, yeah, it was cool. It was fun. He was up here for a conference on psychedelics.
Cool.
And so it was a conference that I spoke at as well. And well, I mean, what can I say about psychedelics? We don't understand them at all. They're inconceivably strange.
Yes.
And yes, they've been used forever as a means of transforming the perception of reality, which they do in a manner that is beyond comprehension. I don't think we understand them at all.
It really is too bad that we don't have the social functioning or the mechanisms or structure to actually facilitate these experiences, and, you know, with like a shaman or someone to guide you through the process so you don't damage yourself. Because it's been immensely valuable for me.
There are people experimenting now under controlled conditions. I mean, they're doing it at Johns Hopkins. With psilocybin, they showed that people who had a mystical experience with psilocybin showed pronounced personality changes 1 year later, mostly an elevation in trait openness. So that was very interesting. And they also used them to help people quit smoking with about an 80% success rate, which was way higher than any pharmacological intervention. You know, when people started to experiment with LSD back in the 60s, the ones who were experimenting properly did understand the necessity of set and setting and a guide. But, you know, the technology, especially with LSD, was so powerful that the culture just couldn't handle it. We didn't know what to do with it. Yeah. You know, it was sort of like the Native Americans when they got introduced to hard alcohol, because they hadn't had alcohol. And, you know, Europeans started with beer and wine. And it's like the, you know, the Brazilians, the South Americans chewing coca leaves. It's like, yeah, you can chew coca leaves, but then you take and make cocaine out of it. It's a whole different beast. Alcohol is the same way. Beer is one thing, but vodka is a whole different thing. And the natives got exposed to alcohol. They had no defense against it at all. Well, LSD was like that for modern people. We had no idea what to do with that stuff. We'd lost any connection we'd had with the psychedelic world. Who knows how long ago? Who knows? Long time ago.
And psychedelics give you an access to those deep, dark parts of your mind, too, as well as the kind of beautiful and transcendent ones.
Yeah, well, that's what happens to people if they have a bad trip.
Not just access, they shove you into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, with communities that use that properly, let's say, so to speak, you're supposed to purify yourself before you experiment. And what that means is that, you know, you should make up with your brother and clean up your house and get your things in order and try to stop lying and straighten out your mind so that if you do play games with it, it won't take you somewhere you seriously do not want to be.
Yep. We did an episode last year about DMT, dimethyltryptamine. And one of the things I mentioned is Yuvi and I are married. We documented about 6 times doing DMT. And one of the times we had fought earlier in the day. And I was a fucking idiot to do this after fighting like that. And I just had gremlins and needles and, you know, bugs crawling up my skin, all of the stuff. Just the worst thing. And it was just all following my train of thought from the day.
Right.
It was terrible. But it also made me realize the value of sorting that subconscious stuff out before you enter into this kind of experience.
Yeah, or how about the value of sorting that stuff out before you enter into any kind of experience?
Yes.
Enter into life.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's the right way to think about it. It happens more slowly, but it's happening at all those levels. And, you know, you don't know exactly. This is part of the mythological world. It's like every decision you make is a decision between good and evil. You don't notice that. Well, you do, actually. You actually do notice that, but it's a micro choice. It doesn't knock you on your ass, you know, but it should. It should.
Were you an atheist before?
Huh, that's a good question. You mean before I started to study all this stuff?
I think I saw in Joe Rogan's interview with you, you said you're religious, and then he said, how do you reconcile that with what you study? And
yeah, well, I talked to you about some of that. Like, I mean, certainly I believe that the fundamental myths they're evolved. They're deeply rooted in us. Like, and the right way of thinking about that is over, really, it's like the myth of dropping a stick on a snake, that's St. George, right? And the world creating hero very frequently creates the world out of the parts of a reptilian monster. Well, that's a story that's like, I don't know how many millions of years old. It's old, old, old. You know, snakes were eating us when we lived in trees. They were one of our primary predators. And the first tree-dwelling primate precursor who dropped a stick on a snake was pretty popular with the ladies.
Wow, I've never thought of that. I suppose Jung talks about that, evolved stories, but I've never thought about that being something that's rooted in biology.
Oh yeah, man, it's down there.
Wow.
And if you think about it as being rooted in our brain structure too, because you have this reptilian brain, and by, first of all, recognizing that it's there and it controls certain parts of your behavior, and then mastering it, you're also kind of killing the snake, or at least you're becoming the master of the snake.
That's right. That's right. That's another metaphor. And it's a useful one. Well, you're wired to respond to the unknown. So that would be everything outside the tree. That would be everything on the forest floor. That would be everything outside the light cast by the campfire. Okay, that's the unknown. What's the unknown? It's a gold-bearing predatory dragon. Why? Well, the dragon is a predator. Right? It's a snake, it's a bird, it's an animal, it's a monster. What's in the dark? A predatory monster. Yes, that's what's in the dark. But the predatory monster has treasure, gold, or it's a female often. Why? Because if you conquer the unknown, you get the treasure. Right? That's the human story. And everyone knows that. That's why they go watch The Hobbit. That's why they go watch Harry Potter. You know, look, the second Harry Potter volume with the basilisk. Okay, it's a magical kingdom. That's the school. The kids are in it. Harry's a rule breaker who's touched by evil. That's what makes him a hero. The basilisk is a predator. It's a snake. It lives underneath the school. It can shake everything to pieces. If you look at it, it freezes you. Why? Because that's how a prey animal responds to a predator. Frozen. It's a snake. It lives underneath everything. That's right, because the snake can shake everything to pieces at any moment. And the magical school is built on chaos. Harry has to go underneath, down, way down, to find the source of the basilisk. He actually gets into it through a toilet or through a bathroom, right? He goes to the dark place, right? The place of refuse and rejection, down into the bowels of the substructure to face the basilisk. What happens? He frees Ginevra. Virgin, and he's half killed doing it. What happens? A phoenix comes along and cries in his wounds. A phoenix is a symbol of rebirth.
It's amazing how deep this goes.
Yes, it goes to the deepest that there is. That's what makes an archetypal story. There isn't anything deeper than an archetypal story. That's it. That's what makes it archetypal. So here's an example. So why is the story of Christ an archetypal story? It's because you can't tell a more tragic story. Okay, so why? What's the basis of tragedy? The most terrible set of possible things happens to the least deserving person. Right, and so that's what happens. So what happens to Christ? All his friends reject him. Betrayed, tortured, killed. That'll do it, that's pretty good. You get social rejection, you get betrayal, you get torture, you get death. Okay, plus mental confusion, terrible mental confusion about destiny. That's the Garden of Gethsemane, right? Okay, so that's on the tragic end. And then on the innocent side, he's the perfect man. And why is he tortured? Because he's good. Archetypal story. You can't push past it. That's what makes it archetypal. Now you might say, is it true? And the answer to that is, it depends on what you mean by true. Is Dostoevsky true? Well, it's fiction. Yeah, but it's more true than real. It's meta-true. It's more real than real. A great novel is more real than real. And a collection of stories like the Bible, that's more real than meta-real. It's more real than fiction is. And if you read it that way, you start to understand what it means. And it'll just blow the substructures right out from underneath you. I spent a lot of time in the last while looking at the story of Moses, which I'll do some videos on it eventually. It's just when you start to understand what these stories mean, they're just absolutely... They're so brilliant that you can't believe it. Cain and Abel is a great example of that. That damn story is a paragraph long. You could think about that story for We've been thinking about that story for 3,000 years. It's a paragraph long. So I can give you a quick rundown of what it means. So Cain and Abel are the first two real human beings, because Adam and Eve are made by God. So these are the first two human beings that live on earth. Well, who are they? Well, they're a pair of brothers who want to kill each other, or Cain does anyways. And so Abel's a good guy. He's making sacrifices, and that pleases God. So what does that mean? Well, it means if you make sacrifices, your life might go okay. Everyone knows that. Now, of course, the sacrifices are concretized in the old story because people had to act things out before they understood them. But it took people a long time to understand that you could make a bargain with the future. Human beings are the only animals that have ever figured that out. Hey, I can let go of something I want now. Try doing that with your dog. You can let go of something I want now, and something better will happen in the future. Well, God, that's an amazing discovery. And the more valuable the thing I let go of now, the more promise I can obtain in the future. That's a bargain with God. Man, that's so brilliant for people to have figured that out. It's just unbelievable that we figured that out. Okay, so Abel's making sacrifices, and they happen to be pleasing to God. It isn't obvious why. You get the impression that he's a pretty good guy, and he's doing it properly. And there's a hint of that, an intimation of that, because he's sacrificing animals and not vegetables. And animals are more valuable than vegetables. They're better food. And he's sacrificing the high quality animals. So he's not stinting in his sacrifice. And he burns this sacrifice because, well, then it turns into spirit, that smoke. And the smoke goes up and God is up. And why is that? Well, have you ever looked at the night sky? It's like it fills you with awe. It's like, well, where's God? Well, he's where awe is. Okay, well, how do you communicate with him? Well, smoke. You know, I mean, you got to give these people some credit, for Christ's sake. They were trying to figure things out. So you burn something valuable, and God can tell. And maybe that's symbolic of your attitude towards life. So maybe it actually works. Anyways, Abel's doing great. Everyone loves him. He's got lots of women. He's got lots of camels and or cows or whatever it was that he had. He's flourishing. Plus, he's a good guy. Everyone loves him, and they know he deserves it. So you just hate him if things aren't going your way. You just hate him. And so Cain gets more and more bitter, and then he goes and has a chat with God, and he says, what kind of stupid planet did you make? I'm breaking myself in half here, trying to get things together. Nothing is working out for me. And then there's this, my bloody brother, Abel, and he's just shining. You know, I just feel horrible when I'm around him. What's going on? And, you know, he's talking to God. He should have been a little more careful. But Abel or Cain is so bitter and so arrogant that he thinks that he's got the answer. And God says to him, it's horrible what he says. He says, sin crouches at your door like a predatory, aroused cat, basically, a predator. But it's sexually aroused. You've invited it into your life to have its way with you. And that creative union between you and sin, which means to miss the mark, by the way, has produced something terrible. And that's what inhabits you. And that's why your life is going terribly. Well, you know, if you're introspective, you say your life is going terribly, and you start thinking about it, you think, oh, well, I made all these mistakes. Why? Oh, well, I'm bitter and I'm resentful and I'm lying. It's like, oh my God, not only am I not making the right sacrifices, but like, I've been living my whole life terribly. So then you're in a real quandary, because not only has everything gone badly for you, it's also your fault. That's what God tells Cain. And then he says, you know, go deal with it. You could deal with it if you wanted to, but you've decided not to. Well, so Cain leaves that conversation and he is not happy. He is seriously, seriously, ultimately not happy. And so he thinks, to hell with this. I'll go kill Abel. That'll teach him. That'll teach Abel, that'll teach God, and that'll screw me over royally. Yeah, well, that's what happens. That's all in one paragraph. It's like, whoa, deadly, deadly, deadly story. And then one of Cain's children, a few generations down the road, his descendants get more and more murderous, Cain's descendants. One of his descendants is Tubal-Cain, and he makes the first weapons of war. And the next story is the flood.
I'm trying to figure out the relevance of the arousal of the predator.
Oh, well, that's easy. It's that thing that's tempting, you invite in like a vampire. Because right. You have to invite a vampire in. And when right. You invite it in, then you have a creative interaction with it. It's not merely that it possesses you, so to speak, or attacks you. It's not that. You invite it in.
You participate.
Brood on it. Brood. That's what a hen does when it's trying to make an egg turn into a chick. It broods on it. Those Columbine kids, they brooded on what they were doing for months and months, maybe years. All those terrible mass shooters, they go into their basement and they brood, and they allow that terrible resentment and ingratitude to possess them. And out of that possession comes something new, right? And that's what, well, that's basically what God tells Cain. It's like, ugh. And it says in the little story, after Cain has a chat with God, it says his countenance falls. It's like, yeah, it falls all right. And then he's off to stick it to God. And if you want the true motivation behind killers like the Columbine kids, that's it. You don't believe that, just read what they wrote. They just tell you. Yeah. You know, they lay it right out. It's not hidden. They hate being. They hate being. That's what the Columbine kids wrote. They'd like to destroy everything. They'd like to burn everything in the most painful possible way.
It's interesting that they can come to that final conclusion. If those types of things are possible, then what do you believe is the meaning or purpose? Is there an ultimate meaning or purpose behind life?
Well, I think that's an empirical question.
Really?
Sure. Did you find this conversation meaningful?
Mm-hmm.
Then that's a hint. When you experience meaning, that's an orientation. It's a real phenomenon. So I can give you an example. So hypothetically, the reason that you found this conversation meaningful is because we were exchanging information, right? We're actually trying to get somewhere with the conversation. I could say, well, that's useful for you right now, but it's also useful for you, the future you. So it's useful today and tomorrow and next week and next month. And then it might be useful for you, and it might be useful for people you're going to interact with, and it might be useful for the broader community. So it's like all these time frames, today, tomorrow, next week, next month, stack up simultaneously, and all these different contexts stack up, and you're operating at all those time frames and in all those contexts simultaneously. And the way you detect that is with meaning. So if what you're doing serves all of those purposes to the degree that what you're doing serves all those purposes simultaneously, you'll be enmeshed in a sense of meaning. And it's a deep, deep, deep instinct that tells you that you're in the right place at the right time. That's the line between chaos and order. That's the Taoist position. One foot in order, one foot in chaos. You're maintaining the order and expanding it and transforming the chaos into habitable space. And that's because chaos and order are the fundamental constituent elements of reality. Really, really, not metaphorically, actually. Fire, unknown. Safety, danger. Culture, nature. That's the fundamental reality. And you have to deal with that. And when you're dealing with it properly, then you're imbued with a sense of meaning. And it's not an epiphenomena. It's the most real thing. It is the most real thing.
That reminds me of something you talked about in another podcast. And you talked about Jung's concept of synchronicity, and the way that he described it is your kind of momentary alignment with the divine.
Yeah. Well, a synchronous moment is when everything lines up. Everything comes together. There's a sexual metaphor lurking in that too. It all came together. Whap. Everything lines up. You can experience that when you listen to music.
Yeah.
Piece of music does that for you. It's like, wow, all these layers, they're all operating simultaneously, perfectly. And, you know, it can be overwhelming. Well, that's an analog. That's what music does. It provides you with an analog of things coming together.
Your amazement that all of these systems function together seems like an ultimate display of synchronicity.
It is a display of synchronicity. I mean, you might say, why do all these things work together? Well, they work together to the degree that people manifest courageous trust, and that's a huge part of it.
Mm.
What's keeping this all together? Courageous trust. It's weird because you wouldn't think that, you know, but that is what it is. It's like, I mean, I can give you an example of that too. eBay is a great example of that because eBay unfroze a lot of frozen assets, right? But it was predicated on this weird idea that you could sell junk to a stranger and they wouldn't send you a bouncing check. So that meant you didn't sell them junk and they didn't send you a check that bounced. And the rate of honest interaction in eBay is staggering. And that was right like that right from the beginning. That could have only worked in a culture where trust was the norm. And all of a sudden it provided access to wealth for people, tremendous wealth. Trust is everything. Trust and honesty, like obviously trust without honesty is just naive stupidity, but courageous trust that's the currency that a complex civilization runs on. And the trust might be, well, I'm trusting that you're orienting yourself towards the good and telling the truth. And then I can negotiate with you, and then we can cooperate and compete.
Mm-hmm. This concept of chaos and order is interesting to me. Actually, that was my first tattoo, chaos on one side and order on the other side. And that you, to find meaning in life and to find happiness, you kind of have to walk this precarious balanced line between the two.
That's right. It's not happiness even. It's better than that. It's proper orientation in being. It's not just happiness. It's much more robust than that. Because it's also what makes you able to tolerate tragedy without becoming corrupt. You know, so for example, if you're living properly on the line between chaos and order, you're a useful person at a funeral. You're not happy, but right. you're a shoulder that people can cry on, and maybe you're the person that can make the arrangements. Right. And you can stand being in a room when someone's dying, and maybe you're there for them and not consumed completely by your own tragedy.
Yuvi and I both practice this style of meditation. We do a mantra meditation, we do an open awareness meditation, and we do a third one, which is meant to feel your deep, dark emotions for a full 10 minutes. So you focus on the thing that causes you the most emotional pain, and you sit in that emotion. Mm-hmm. And it relates to what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation of immersing yourself in challenging emotions so that you can become more resilient.
Sounds like a good practice. Mm-hmm. How has it worked for you?
When people ask me why I do that, I generally answer, and this is sort of a half truth, but I generally answer because it prepares me for future events. You know, it's inevitable that my parents are going to die. And so I can be a shoulder to cry on for my siblings, or I can be adding to the misery because I'm just as shocked as they are.
That's exactly it. And that's what I meant by reducing unnecessary suffering. Mm-hmm. That's right. You can take a bad situation. Like my wife's family, my wife's mother died seven years ago, and she had a degenerative neurological disease like Alzheimer's. She developed it very early. And two things occurred as a consequence of that. First of all, her husband took care of her, and he did it unbelievably well. And he was kind of he's a very interesting person. I really like him. He's unbelievably extroverted and kind of a jester type. Everybody in our small town knew him. He was a drinker, and that was problematic, but he was a happy drinker. He kind of played the fool to some degree, but he's no fool, not in the least. And then when his wife got sick, man, he just took care of her like you wouldn't believe. And it was so interesting because he was also open for help, not asking for it and not whining about it. None of that at all. But if you had something that would help, like I recommended, for example, that he get an LED sign that was programmable so that when he went out, he could have it on the fridge and it would just repeat where he went over and over so she knew where he was. And he picked that up right away. And it's hard to take help, you know, in a situation like that. And anyways, he took care of her until he couldn't lift her out of the chair anymore. And so that was amazing to watch, man. It was just blew me away how good he was at that. And then when she was dying, we were all there. And my wife, Tammy, she volunteered in a palliative care ward. And she's very good with that sort of thing. And her sister was a palliative care nurse. And her other sister was a pharmacist. And so these are people who've learn to cope with tragedy. And, you know, it was a tragic experience. But one of the things that was very interesting was that it actually the family came together. And as a consequence of that event, their bonds actually strengthened substantially, all of them. And so they lost, obviously, because they lost their mother. But first of all, they didn't make a bad situation worse, because they could have turned tragedy into hell with no problem. Yeah. And second, because they faced it properly, it was the least amount terrible it had to be.
Right. That's exactly it. Yeah. It's useful for paramedics too, I would imagine. I mean, you get used to it just from on-the-job experience. But I mean, if you're trained to be a paramedic, then I imagine this kind of meditation would be extremely useful, because you'd be able to maintain a level of focus and calm when a situation comes that you're needed.
The core doctrine of Jungian psychotherapy is basically, I never know if I'm saying the Latin properly, but it's instirquilinus invenitur, which means roughly, it means in filth that will be found. But what it means is thing you want most is to be found where you least want to look. That's a dragon idea too, right? It's in the terrible predatory unknown, the gold will be found. That's the human story. That's what we're like. We're information foragers. And that's our myth. Is it true? It's like, well, we'll see. We're living it out. We're seeing if it works.
Yeah. The sad and ironic and hilarious part of that is we might never know, because we don't know. You die. That's the end result of everybody's story. So you don't know if you're ever going to make it.
biggest part of it, you know, is whether it's worthwhile while you're alive.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you can tell when what you're doing is worthwhile. Now, you can undermine that rationally and you say, well, in a million years, who's going to know the difference? It's like the right answer to that question is it's like the dress question. It's like that's a stupid frame of reference. Well, you can pick a frame of reference that makes everything. It's like children were killed in Auschwitz. Well, in a billion years, who's going to care? Well, what kind of stupid answer is that? It's like, sorry, wrong theory.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're adopting a framework of reference that makes everything you do meaningless, you might start questioning whether or not that's an appropriate framework of reference.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on what you decide to make primary, because you have to make that decision. That's also why faith is necessary. You have to decide what you're going to make primary.
Yeah. Any more questions, Yuvi?
Well, we have quite a lot of young listeners, and they often ask us, what can they do to sort of contribute to the world or to make their life meaningful? What would you answer to them?
I would say choose your words carefully. Learn how to write. Learn how to think. Learn how to communicate. Learn how to articulate yourself. That makes you more powerful than anything else you can possibly do. And then try to make things better. Start with what you can make better. Start by making your relationships with your friends better. Start by making your relationships with your parents better. Start by adhering more carefully to your discipline when you're pursuing something that you think is worthwhile. Straighten yourself out. And you start doing that by stopping doing the things you know you shouldn't do. Simple as that. You know there's a set of things that you're doing. You know you shouldn't do them. Some of them you could even stop. Stop doing them. It'll make you a little more together. And as soon as you're a little more together, there's something else stupid you'll be able to stop doing. Stop doing that. You do that for 3 or 4 years, man, you'll be a whole different person. You do that for a lifetime, you'll be a deadly force for good in the world. And that's what you should be.
Interesting choice of words.
Yeah, well, being good and being nice are not the same thing at all. They're not even close.
Mm-hmm.
If you're nice, you just get pushed over. Nice doesn't have a chance against malevolent. It doesn't have a chance. It's just a quivering rabbit. That's all.
Yeah.
Nice gets you nowhere in a real battle.
And you have this self-authoring course online.
That's a good one. The self-authoring course has 3 modules. The first one helps people write an autobiography. So you identify the most emotionally significant elements of your life and analyze the negative ones in particular so that you can leave them behind. You have to learn from your negative experiences what is necessary so you won't repeat them. Right? That's the purpose of knowledge.
Right.
And then the second module helps you identify your personality faults and virtues and overcome the former and capitalize on the latter. And the third one helps you write a plan for your future 3 to 5 years down the road. And so you write about what your life would be like if you were taking care of yourself properly, like you were someone you cared about, and how you would like your family to be arranged, your intimate relationships, your career, your education, your use of time outside of work, and your use of drugs and alcohol. And then you want to figure out what you are aiming at, that you desire and want, that would be valuable. And we ask you to think about it in relationship to you and your family and the community, and now and next week and next month. So trying to get all that lined up. And we also have you write about what your life would be like in 3 to 5 years if you let everything go to hell, if you let your bad habits and so forth overcome you and take you down. And that gives you something to run away from and something to run towards. And that is motivating.
Yeah, Tony Robbins talks about that a lot. You always need an equivalent pain to go along with your reward.
Yeah, well, you're a lot faster if you're running away from something that you don't want to be near towards something that you want.
Right.
See, that way you get your anxiety working for you instead of against you. Because you might say, well, why should I do this work? It's hard and it's anxiety provoking. It's like, then you think, oh, well, if I don't do what I'm supposed to, I'm going to end up in that little hell that I delineated. And you really want to think about it, because then you think, oh yeah, I'm not going there. I'm going to do this.
What gives you optimism about the future?
Sociologically, there's lots of things, you know. I mean, 300,000 more people will be connected to the world's power grid today, and 250,000 people will be lifted out of abject poverty. We're solving those problems faster than we ever have in the history of the planet. I mean, the amount of wealth that's been created in the last 15 years is absolutely unparalleled in human history. So many things are getting better, and we could continue that. And lots of people are working hard trying to make things better. enough people so that, you know, at least we have some functioning societies, and there's some possibility that we'll be able to expand those. So that makes me optimistic. I mean, I would also say that teaching people makes me optimistic. I mean, I put a lot of material out on YouTube, as you two well know, and, you know, the reception has been overwhelming. And I'm always talking about the same things I'm talking to you guys about. I'm talking about not being deceitful. I'm talking about, you know, bearing a heavy responsibility and getting yourself oriented in life. And people are just eating that up. It's like, good.
Yeah.
No, people are hungry for that. They're starving for that. That's spiritual bread, right?
Yep. Yeah, it seems like all this controversy lately has just sort of expanded your reach and ability to connect with people. So I wish you more controversy.
Good one. Good one. Yeah, well, that's the thing, you know, and I do try to live the way that I've been describing. I try to say what I think and see what happens. And it's ridiculous. That's the other thing. It's ridiculously interesting to do that because you don't know what's going to happen. So it's a real adventure to do that. It's like, well, I'm going to say what I think. Well, is that going to work? I don't know. What do you mean by work? That's the issue. What do you mean by work? I'm going to say what I think carefully, which as carefully as I can, and observe the results. That's very, it's meaningful. It's ridiculously meaningful because you don't know exactly what's going to happen. It's like, who knows what'll happen? I couldn't have predicted this. And I had no idea that making those little videos was going to do anything. I was mostly trying to figure out what I was thinking. Huh. And experimenting. What happens if I make a video about this? Yeah. Oh, isn't that interesting? It's ridiculously interesting. It was too interesting for a while.
Yeah, too many people having a window into your life?
Well, and just the uncertainty that went along with it. I mean, my job was definitely in doubt for 3 months. It was really hard on my family. They're tough, though.
I noticed your Patreon account is going well. It seems like you're pulling a bit of income from that. So has that been in response to the...
Well, I had started it back last April, you know, and it had started to develop. That was, again, curiosity. I found this Patreon. I was thinking about monetizing the videos because, well, I could use some production help and that kind of thing, and also curiosity. But I thought the material just doesn't suit advertisements, you know?
Yep.
And so I thought, no, I can't do that. It just was annoying. And then I found this Patreon site and I thought, oh, that's cool. Might as well set one up just out of curiosity. I mean, it was new, right? So I didn't know what was going to happen. And then people started to subscribe, support, however you want to put it. And that started to grow. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then, of course, all this political stuff happened and it just went. And then I'd be able to, you know, well, the production quality of the videos has expanded substantially. And I've been able to hire some people to help me, and I'm concentrating very much on video production. Once I'm done teaching, which basically happens at about halfway through April, one of the things I want to do, I'm going to do a whole series on, I'm going to see if I can lecture on the Bible right from the beginning to the end. And take
Whoa, cool.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Cool. I'm going to rent a church, I think, because there's one down the street where I can rent it for like $125 an hour, and it'll sit 500 or 600 people. So I'll do it there and videotape it. I'd like to go right from the beginning to the end. That'll take me 5 years probably or longer, but that would be, well, I think that's what I'm going to do.
I'd love to see more stuff on Jung and Freud.
Yeah, well, that's in the offings as well. And I'm trying to, the thing is that I'm trying to reorganize my life to take into account the potency of YouTube, but I'm still not exactly certain about what that means. I mean, it means that I have the chance to offer information to thousands and thousands of people, but exactly how that should fit into my life, well, that's a complicated question. So I'm still sorting that out. But, you know, it's happening incrementally. The production value is way up, and I'm starting to interview people and so on and formulating ideas for the future.
You could also put your courses on Udemy and Coursera and places like that and charge for them.
That's true. I could also do that. So and that would make the courses more specific, you know, and potentially open the door to accredit people. So, yeah, so there's lots of things to think about. And I'm still tangled up with all sorts of obligations apart from that. They're good tangles, but they do stop me from concentrating as much on, let's say, video education as I might.
Jordan, thanks for joining us. This has been an awesome conversation.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we would love to speak to you again sometime. I'm sure our audience would love it too.
All right. Good to meet you.
We'd love to help.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. To get any show notes, links, mentions, books that we talked about in this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/39. And don't forget to check out Eternity at futurethinkers.org/AE.
See you guys in the next episode. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Future Thinkers podcast. To get notified of new podcasts and videos, go to futurethinkers.org and subscribe to our mailing list. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, give us a like or a review, share it with your friends, and consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/futurethinkers. If you're looking to get serious about meditation, check out the meditation app that we've created with Vinay Gupta called The Cutting Machinery. Go to cuttingmachinery.org/app.
Last but not least, if you want to get access to more content, hidden episodes, or if you just want to chat with us and previous guests, then check out our community at community.futurethinkers.org.